Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it's 2:49 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is July 28th, and I thought I'd kick off with the JOLTS index, the job openings by industry total. But the reason I'm starting off with that is because it looks like it's peaking. So we had the GDP figure come in today, and it was well below expectations in negative territory. So that's two consecutive quarters of negative growth, which is the technical definition of a recession. But I thought Janet Yellen's or the interview she gave today was rather humorous. It reminded me of the parlance, love that dare not speak its name, because they were avoiding calling this a recession by every possible means. And the number one reason that she was giving for that was because of the strength of the labor market. But the thing that occurs to me is if we look at the long-term history of this chart, we can see that the recession in 2007 and 8, well, it was exceptionally deep. Everybody's aware of that. And it resulted in a massive increase in unemployment. And Yellen today quoted that at in excess of 10%. And the number of available jobs fell from about 5 million to 2 million. So that was a really significant contraction in the economy. But let's contrast that with the size of the pullback that we had in 2020. So it came down from about 7.5 million to about, let's call it 4.5 million. So another contraction of 3 million jobs, but this time from a much higher level. And the number of job openings has been trending higher all the way through the economic expansion that began in 2009. And a good part of the reason for that is because of the lack of new workers or new qualified workers or highly qualified workers coming in as a result of immigration. So it's become a lot more difficult to secure an immigrant visa or a work visa into the USA since the Trump administration. But then we had this phenomenal acceleration in 2020 through to now. And there's a lot of people talking about the mass resignation. I just don't give that any credence. But what we have had is a lot of people leaving the workforce because they're retiring. And this, and perhaps the pandemic might have accelerated the pace of retirements somewhat. But the reality is that we have a large segment of the population that are approaching retirement, making decisions about whether they want to keep working or not, or whether they want to keep working to the same extent any longer. Then that alone isn't enough to really explain the acceleration that we had, where the number of job openings went from about 4 million and change up to 12 million. So there is an alternative way of thinking about it, and it's about money supply. We had this incredible monetary and fiscal stimulus, where every possible conduit through which money could be pushed into the economy was utilized. And that included direct transfers to consumers. So people got money, spent money, borrowed money, spent money. Demand for everything jumped higher. Now, if you're a business trying to meet that demand, and you suddenly find yourself with more orders than you could possibly have imagined, then you have to, one, buy more. But then you also have to hire more people to try and meet that demand. So you advertise new jobs. So then one would have to at least give some credence to the possibility that this massive surge in available jobs is more like the afterglow of the massive increase in money supply. And therefore, it's reasonable that the number of available jobs will contract in just the same way that money supply has, because money supply growth is now negative. So we're in a different kind of recession, because There are a couple of things on this occasion that are quite different. And I know that that is a very dangerous thing to talk about in terms of financial markets to say that this time is different. But perhaps it's not that different, just that we're getting a reordering of the timing of various different aspects to a recession. So, one thing that's I think important is we've never actually had a recession without the PMI coming below 50, so going from expansion into contraction. Now, it's going to be updated again next week, and it could easily be below 50 when it is updated, but at the moment it's not quite there yet. So that's certainly something. Then, of course, we have all these job openings, but we also have very low unemployment. And usually in a recession, you'd anticipate that unemployment would already be increasing and would increase further. So the number of new jobless claims is trending higher. And it's been trending higher since March of this year. But coming off of pretty much the same lows that it was at prior to the pandemic. Now, one thing that I think is important to highlight is that prior to the enormous spike in unemployment that we had during the pandemic, then claims in excess of 250,000 would have been concerning. And we saw that there was a clear downward trend all the way through from the peak in 2008, or I guess it was really the peak was in 2009. So that was the clear trend. So now let's just try and take that spike out again. And we can see that we've definitely got more of a V-shaped recovery now, and it is back above the 250,000 number. But because of this extraordinary volatility, it's going to take time for economic statistics to settle down. And that time is probably going to be measured in years. So we're in a rather interesting environment. And I've described this in previous broadcasts as a pendulum effect, and I wrote about that in here today just to re-emphasize the point. But I do think that what we're going to see now is a lot more variability in the way that statistics are interpreted, because a lot of the patterns of recognition that economists have had to rely on and have comfortably relied on for years aren't going to be as efficacious because of this massive impact of the pandemic and the residual effects of the pandemic, both in terms of supply, demand, and then geopolitics. What's happening right now in terms of the semiconductors sector is a very good example of that. So the semiconductors index is back testing the region of the succession of lower rally highs, and this has been a really quite meaningful rebound from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, we're looking at various countries who feel like they were burned by the pandemic. They saw this massive increase in demand and an inability to increase supply of semiconductors. So China is in the process of building something, and I'm going to get these numbers wrong, but it's something like 30 semiconductor fabs right now. The USA just passed a bill to spend well in excess of $100 billion on domestic fabrication of semiconductors, and Europe is doing much the same thing. So this is also obviously good news for a company like ASML, which has an order book stretching out for years, and it's had a meaningful rebound. But the problem for all of this enthusiasm is that when these fabs are built, then demand is going to evaporate because prices will collapse. And this is emblematic of the cyclicality that we have in the semiconductors index, or the in the industry. So, but we're definitely getting more demand for risk on right now. So we've had a meaningful rebound in the semiconductors sector. Then we can think about Shopify. So this is a stock that has collapsed in value over the course of the last year. And it was up today and it was up yesterday. And that's despite falling sales. But this is a pattern that we have now in a really significant number of these high growth and less than profitable or less than impressively profitable companies, where we got this really incredible decline, and then they've been going sideways in a very narrow band for the last 4 months. So, negative results, but positive performance in the stock. So, there's the potential here that we could be looking at a base formation, but at least a base formation to unwind the short-term oversold condition relative to the 200-day moving average. But in Shopify's case, that could be a rally of 100%. Etsy has been able to hold on to its sales from the pandemic, and the share really did pull back violently over the course of the last year, and now it's breaking up and out of its own 4 month little base formation. So this is more impressive in terms of its performance. We can think about Spotify. The one thing I will say, just with my own family, is I can argue with my kids about whether we should have a Netflix or a Hulu or a HBO subscription, but the one thing they won't ever consider canceling is Spotify. And that's, I think, a very strong vote of confidence in the sustainability of their subscriber business model. And the share was in negative territory today. Now they think they're going to have 1 billion subscribers within the next few years. So the share is also exhibiting this 3 to 4 month base formation, and it's at the upper side of it. And of course, yesterday we had PayPal was the leading advancer in the S&P 500. It sold off a little earlier on today, but it also has this very clear 3 month base formation, and that's following really what was a cataclysmic decline, coming from 300 down to about 70. So we're definitely getting more interest in a risk-on type of environment. And a good part of the reason for that is because bond yields are coming down. So investors are looking at the fact that we have had two negative quarters of growth already, and that it's unlikely the Federal Reserve is going to continue to raise aggressively into a recessionary environment. And therefore, we're and what the market has priced in basically is that we'll be at the end of the tightening cycle by the end of the year. And of course, we're at the end of July now. So there's only 5 months left in the year. So investors are basically making the judgment that we've already had a big pullback. How much worse could it possibly be if we're close to the end of the tightening cycle? And the 10-year yield is back below the 2 point or 2.75% level. So this is a meaningful breakdown. And it's increasingly looking like a failed upside break. And if it is a failed upside break, well, then we give the benefit of the doubt to the downside at, excuse me, and a pullback all the way to the lower side of the range, which is around 1.5%. Now, I don't think anyone really is as bullish, is that bullish of bonds right now, but that is what a failed upside break suggests. So therefore, we should be prepared for that outcome. Now, if bond yields compress by another 100 basis points, we could easily get a significant rebound in a lot of those risk on type shares. We're also seeing that Bitcoin continues to hold the short-term sequence of higher reaction lows, and it was in positive territory again in here today. And since this is a liquidity barometer, and certainly one of the most volatile of the risk assets, the fact that it is continuing to hold this sequence is really quite bullish. And then the advance in government bond yields was one of the big negatives for gold. So gold prices are also rebounding. So we had the upside Q reversal a week ago and some follow through now, but this is definitely clearer follow through on the upside and starting to show up on the weekly chart. So it's looking like at least short term support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average and the lower side of the range. And I'm rather sorry that I didn't just take the pain and hold on to my precious metal leveraged positions. So now I'm questioning whether I should just buy them back. But I think I'm just going to wait a while. I don't feel like I need to be in a rush right now because we've definitely seen that volatility has been coming back down. But I do think that there's still scope for a couple of negative surprises. The other interesting development right now is copper. So copper got up to the $3.50 area in here today, wasn't quite able to hold it. And I don't like putting physical stops in the market. If I'd had one, it would have been triggered. But if I see a close above 350, I'll take it out. The reality here is we had a short-term oversold condition. The price has climbed back up towards this first area of potential resistance. But if we're in an economic contraction, then it's hard to argue that we're going to have a significant supply or demand increase for copper, even if we're going to have a massive revolution in terms of electric vehicles. So we're, I think, in now a more of a risk-on environment, but that's also because we have these exceptionally clear short-term oversold conditions. And that's also particularly evident in the yen. So we have a very clear short-term oversold condition, and it's beginning to be unwound. So it could easily come back into the region of the 200-day moving average. And there's the possibility here that what we could have is the classic experience of a mean reversion after a downward acceleration, which is then followed by a prolonged period of ranging. And that's, I think, perhaps one of the more likely scenarios for some of the high growth portions of the market, particularly those that do not have very clear routes to profitability. So, investors, I think, are still of the mindset that we're going to have the Federal Reserve ride to the rescue, and that the Fed put, whether you want to call it the Greenspan, Bernanke, Yellen, or Powell put, is still in effect. There is the potential instead that it might be a Fed call that we now have, where the better the market does, the greater the feeling or the wealth effect that people find, and therefore the less likely it is that inflation is going to be contained. So then the Fed would have to tighten further. So that's potentially what we could be looking at by the time we get out to perhaps September. And it's not unusual to see a low in the market sometime in July, August. Usually, when people come back from holiday in September after Labor Day, they will notice that a low has already been formed, and then they will start to initiate long positions. So I think we are starting to see a little bit of anticipation of an easier monetary environment. Then, of course, you have the fact that China has started to bail out the property sector. We can see that the US is getting closer to its big spending program. So that would also be additional liquidity. And of course, the big outlier, the big source of potential risk is the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And oil prices were a little easier in here today, but certainly not coming back in a dynamic manner. And then we have natural gas prices, which fell in the USA, so pulling back from the recent peak, and down as well in the Netherlands, but still at exceptionally high levels. I think one thing that there is a tendency to think that inflation is completely entrenched. There's also a tendency to think that oil prices are going to be higher forever. But ultimately, supply and demand will normalize. Now, when we think about the carbon credits market, carbon credits are still at really high levels. And these are the product of a political decision. So Europe wants higher energy prices, and they want an energy transition, and they're charging people and they're ensuring a high price to try and affect that change. They thought that they would have access to abundant natural gas indefinitely and that they'd have as much time as they needed to do that transition, and now they've been disabused of that view. But the energy transition, it will eventually occur because it will have to. Russia wants to ensure Europeans are uncomfortable this winter. They want to bring Europe to the table. They want sanctions dropped, and they want realpolitik to basically accept that they've taken over part of Ukraine and that that is now the de facto situation. So, they are going to ensure that Europe does not have as much gas as it requires in order to force a decision. Europe is going to have to either get rid of carbon credits, restart uranium and or nuclear reactors, fire up a lot more coal-fired power stations, build more wind turbines, put in more solar panels. The UK, for example, was talking until quite recently, and I'm not sure if it's still underway, but putting in a deep sea cable all the way to Morocco and putting in a bunch of solar panels there. Now, I guess putting in a several thousand mile long, or I guess a thousand mile long, electrical cable between the UK and Morocco is an awfully big target from a geopolitical perspective. But the reality is, we're going to see these kinds of solutions. Supply and demand will come back into balance. So it's either going to happen because supply increases. And supply could easily increase if we just got out of our own way and started removing some of the really onerous and, in many respects, obtuse regulations that inhibit supply growth in the fossil fuel sector and the nuclear sector. Or we're going to see demand contract. And from a European perspective, that would really represent an incredibly deep recession. So it's really all to play for, and it's really up to populations to vote the way they want. So there is the potential, at least, that Russia forcing Europe to actually face up to these decisions might actually accelerate the energy transition. But and we've already started to see some of the efforts underway to ensure that both natural gas and uranium are now qualified as green investments. So there's certainly the potential, at least, that Europe will decide to rule in its own best interests eventually. So the uranium ETF is now starting to rebound. And this is also rebounding from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. It's emblematic of the wider risk-on environment. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.